This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen. Hi, and welcome back to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the courts and the law and the rule of law. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I cover the courts and the law. And this week, Donald J. Trump started to argue that his New York criminal trial for conduct that took place before the 2016 election should be paused pending the Supreme Court's someday ruling in his immunity trial in Washington, D.C. Why? Because immunity is a forever condition and it shields you from all of your conduct ever before and after. Amen. Trump also defamed E. Jean Carroll again. And as of this taping, both Donald Trump and Joseph Biden are their party's presumptive nominees. It's official. The 2024 presidential election is Trump v. Biden, the rematch. Later on in the show, our Slate Plus subscribers are going to get to hear from Mark Joseph Stern about the fight in Fifth Circuit taking a swing at access to contraception, and also about an attempt to finally rein in the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine's favorite extracurricular hobby, judge shopping. If you are not a Slate Plus member, but you'd like to hear extra segments like my conversations with Mark Stern or urgent updates with our Law of Trump correspondent, Jeremy Stahl, and if you would like to enjoy all of Slate's podcasts ad-free plus unlimited reading at slate.com, head on over to slate.com/amicusplus for details on how to access all the perks of membership. And to our Slate Plus subscribers, you're the best. Seriously, the best. Thank you for your various breathtaking and moving AI-generated country and Western versions of The Law is So Darn Slow or The Amicus Lament. But now to the main show, where we want to talk about truth, which has become something of an obsession for us here at Amicus because it seems to be disintegrating before our very eyes, or at least it seems to be up for debate as to every particular. As Barb McQuaid noted on last week's show, this fight over what is true and what is fake seems to be taking the entire machinery of law and democracy right down with it, and it's happening at high velocities. This week, we wanted to apply that theory to case law and to fill in the stakes of an appeal that will be heard at the High Court on Monday morning. And it's a case that's flying a little bit under the radar. Murthy versus Missouri sits at the contested intersection of social media, government, and truth. It's the product of a lawsuit filed by the attorneys general of Missouri and Louisiana, and a group of social media users, among them are some doctors and right-wing media members, who contend that officials in the Biden administration censored their online speech related to COVID-19 vaccines and masking policies, and also the 2020 election and other issues, by pressuring big tech to remove online posts. They won at a court below, which barred any of the government agencies named in the suit from working together with social media platforms on issues related to protected speech. Even before this case is heard, it's been having a profound chilling effect on preparations for the 2024 elections. Preparations by the very folks in charge of ensuring a free and fair vote this November, election workers. Gauri Ramachandran serves as deputy director in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Her work focuses on election security, election administration, and combating election disinformation. And she is on the amicus brief that was filed by the Brennan Center in Murphy.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So the shouting about this case, to the extent that there is shouting about this case, and I think it hasn't gotten the attention it deserved, has mostly been in the vein of, hey, get the deep state out of my social media, and folks accusing the Biden administration of censorship. But the focus of your specific brief in this case is actually pretty different. So can you just give us the sort of 40,000 feet take on why the court needs to, in their thinking about this case, also take in the interests and the impacts of a ruling on election workers?
Sure. We filed an amicus brief in this case on behalf of a bipartisan group of state and local election officials, precisely because I think the shouting, as you say, has really focused on issues like COVID-19 and discussions of vaccine safety online and that sort of thing. But the potential implications of this case for election officials and their staff, the election workers who work really hard and get up really early in the morning on election day to serve all of us, the implications for them are really strong. And we wanted to make sure that the court is aware of that and has it top of mind as they're crafting their decision in this case. And one of the reasons it's so important is that disinformation about elections and election processes online is one of the, you know, components in the abuse and harassment and threats that election workers have been receiving since the 2020 election. At the Brennan Center, we do an annual survey of local election officials. And every year since we started the survey in 2021, people have mentioned that this false information, including online, about the work that they do is one of the sort of driving factors in their view.
These threats to election officials, they tend to pop up in the news, you know, on election day, right? We all know about the armed, masked vigilantes in tactical gear that were hanging out outside a ballot drop box in Maricopa County in 2022. That we think of that as the Death Star, right, of how badly and menacing these threats to election workers can be. And of course, I think we probably think of Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, who right now stand for the unremarkable proposition that to be a person working elections carries a non-trivial risk of, you know, a lifetime of doxing and death threats and again, the menace of people coming to your home. I wonder if you can just help us understand the intersection between sort of those threats and the kinds of people who are dropping out of doing this work, the kinds of people who are dropping into this work. In other words, this is not an invisible problem to the kinds of folks who have worked elections often for decades and decades. And what's their response?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Another thing that we have found in our annual survey of local election officials, so these are the nearly 10,000 clerks, registrars, recorders all over the country who administer elections. One of the things we've found is that there's been a pretty high level of turnover in that group since the 2020 election. And actually, the last time we did our survey last year, we found that putting together the folks who were planning to leave by this presidential election cycle and the folks who had were new to the job and had joined since 2020, putting all that together, we found that about 1 in 5 local election officials this cycle will be administering their first presidential election. Now, obviously, there's turnover in any type of profession for all kinds of reasons, but it's clear that the harassment and abuse that people are facing in this profession is a factor that people are taking into account in an already typically underpaid and stressful job.
You've been looking at state and local office holders as well as election workers. And mm-hmm. the numbers in your report, as you've just suggested, are fairly staggering on their own terms. You wrote more than 40% of state legislators experienced threats or attacks within the past 3 years. More than 18% of local office holders experienced threats or attacks in the past year and a half. The numbers ballooned to 89% of state legislators and 52% of local office holders with less severe forms of abuse, which, you know, you characterize as the kinds of things that are insults, harassment, stalking. It's hard to imagine that's lesser, but there it is. And I wondered if you just kind of help me understand, you know, threats against election workers versus office holders. They're slightly different. I know for purposes of this conversation, we're slightly conflating them, but can you just peel back, you know, the difference between folks who work elections day of and office holders that you've been doing these surveys, and tell me just sort of the commonalities between the ways they're threatened and where and if their interests diverge?
So, as you mentioned, I've also worked on some research we've done at the Brennan Center on threats, harassment, and other forms of abuse that state and local office holders have experienced. So those populations that we surveyed and that we interviewed include people like city council members, state legislators, people in the state assembly, for instance, or the state senate, county board commissioners, all of those sorts of folks. And as you mentioned, the level of threats and abuse that those populations are experiencing is extremely high. And large numbers of those populations reported to us that the amount or the severity of the abuse has been increasing in the last few years. So I think what's common between that group and election officials and election workers is that all of them are experiencing this sort of rise in extremism, frankly, and rise in certain populations that are finding it acceptable to engage in this behavior. And rather than engaging in, you know, civil discourse and having, you know, vigorous policy disagreements or making their opinions known to their public officials who either serve them in election administration or serve them as an elected official, rather than doing that, they're engaging in this kind of abuse and harassment. So that's something I think that all of these groups are feeling and experiencing in common. I think what's different is that election officials are a mix of elected and non-elected people. So some clerks are actually elected by their municipality. Some, you know, county registrars are elected. In other places, they're appointed. So you might have a county board of supervisors or a city council or that sort of thing that hires the person who is the election administrator. Sometimes it's a nonpartisan office, like a judge or that sort of thing, where people run for office, but they're not listing a party affiliation on the ballot or anything like that. In other places, they actually will list a party affiliation on the ballot or be open about it. So it's a real mix of people, but I think what they hold in common is largely a culture of performing their jobs in a nonpartisan fashion and feeling that their primary duty is to the voters and to administering a free and fair election in a nonpartisan fashion. And that is something that I think has made a lot of election workers and election officials, it just made them unprepared for the onslaught that occurred after the 2020 election. These are typically, even if elected, pretty kind of sleepy, under the radar races. It's not a big controversy, typically, or at least it wasn't, you know, before the 2020 election. So I don't want to say anyone should expect abuse in their job, right? Nobody should. And it's really harmful to democracy if any public official has to experience this abuse. But I think election officials in particular just did not expect this kind of negative attention.
We're going to take a short break now to hear from some of our great sponsors on this week's show.
Thank you. Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? Or what is the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen. And we're back now to our conversation with Gauri Ramachandran on Murthy versus Missouri, a case with huge implications for election workers. I've been wondering whether, I asked it sort of elliptically in an earlier question, but are the folks who are stepping down, either because they're older or they had a bad experience or they're scared, being replaced by people who, in your sense, are more sort of partisan or more, you know, apt to say, okay, this is, you know, this is trench warfare and I'm here to fight? Or is it your sense that the folks who are filling those jobs are still just trying to be sort of good local public servants who are administering elections fairly? Or is it just too early to know?
I think it's both too early to know and just a question that I haven't delved into or really researched. I will say that every time we do this survey, we hear from election officials that despite all of these concerning issues, they are really motivated to do their jobs by, you know, altruistic and public service ideals, such as making sure that every eligible voter's vote counts, serving their public, you know, being proud of helping democracy function. And I think that those motivating factors are, you would imagine those are the kinds of things that would attract a lot of people to fill these positions as well in the current environment. That said, I would say I am still quite concerned about the number of new local election officials administering, you know, their first presidential election this cycle. And that's because this is a job that requires a lot of precision. It entails a lot of types of work that it didn't used to. So you have to be a cybersecurity expert now. You have to learn about communications, crisis communications, how to explain things to voters so that they don't fall victim to conspiracy theories about the election. And doing all of that and doing it new and in the pressures of a presidential election cycle, it just makes it really easy to make mistakes. People are human. And every time there's a mistake, that's another opportunity for people to jump on it and fuel a bunch of rumors and conspiracy theories about elections.
And one last beat on this before we turn to Murphy, which is, this just doesn't get covered very much. It gets covered, you know, in the case of Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, it gets covered again, day of when, you know, you'll hear a sort of sporadic local story of somebody bullying an election worker or somebody, you know, whatever, bringing a firearm to a polling place. But this then kind of drifts away from public consciousness. And yet this is, in some sense, the beating heart of election administration. If these folks do not feel safe and if they feel intimidated or they feel that it's not worth doing this job at all anymore, that's how we do elections. There's not a plan B for this.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, that this issue is not often covered in between elections and in these sort of quieter periods, at least in the public consciousness, in part because there is a lot that local election officials are doing to help their staff be safe and feel safe. So many local election officials are getting in touch with law enforcement well ahead of time, coordinating with them, educating law enforcement about when does early voting start, right? When is election day? When is the presidential preference primary? And what is your role? You know, is this the sort of thing where you should be showing up at the polling place at the first hint of a disturbance, you know, in full SWAT gear? Or is this a situation where it makes a lot more sense for you to have my phone number and for us to be in close touch and you to coordinate with me about what's an appropriate and helpful response to make sure that voters and workers and everyone else is safe?
Okay, so let's talk about Murphy, because I think it's largely been framed as a case about what's called jawboning, right? This is the Biden administration in some heavy-handed ways, in some much more chill ways, telling social media platforms to remove content that's not true about COVID, to take down things that are, you know, false and inflammatory. But it intersects absolutely with the interests of election workers. Why?
Even though false information about COVID and vaccines is really the focus of a lot of the plaintiffs' arguments in this case and the lower court orders in this case, a huge number of defendants were actually sued in this case, many agencies all across the federal government. And included in that list was CISA, which is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. So this is an agency that was formed in the wake of the 2016 election, in fact, and whose job it is to assist state, local, and tribal officials with cybersecurity response and really just protecting election infrastructure against interference. So it has a big impact on election workers that CISA was one of the defendants in this case, because the original court order where the plaintiffs won actually swept in groups like CISA and other elements of the federal government and enjoined them from talking to the social media companies with the purpose of, you know, them engaging in some content moderation under their own policies. It enjoined that for all kinds of speech. It wasn't restricted to just, you know, vaccine information. So what happened is that even though that court order has been stayed because the Supreme Court took up the case, it has really chilled government officials from sharing information with and being in touch with social media companies. So that means all the work that these agencies were doing in the run-up to the 2020 election is not happening, and certainly not at the kind of scale it was happening before. So that means notifying the social media companies when they become aware of a user on their platforms that appears to be an agent of a foreign government and is spreading propaganda on the platform, right? Senator Warner, in his role on the Intelligence Committee, he actually mentioned earlier this week that since July, when that original district court order came down, up until about 2 weeks ago, there had been zero communication between federal agencies that have this election expertise and security expertise, zero communication between those agencies and social media companies, which is a real problem. He noted rightly that the CEO of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, even said after the 2016 election, if there's you know, foreign agents on our platforms spreading misinformation, tell us. We want to do something about it. We voluntarily want to do something about it. So please tell us. And then that is what occurred after that, really to credit the government. They did it. They formed a relationship with the social media companies and provided them this information. And then that communication stopped after this district court order. And it doesn't seem that it really restarted immediately after the order was stayed. So it does have a really big impact. We're actually getting less cooperation than we did in the run-up to the 2020 election.
And I'm going to just ask you the Captain Obvious follow-up, but that is, it's not as if attempts at election interference have stopped, right? It's not as though, oh, it stopped because there's no foreign entities that are trying to influence elections, or there's no malefactors here in the U.S. who are trying to put election misinformation out there. It stopped not because it's not needed, but because of just vast confusion about what can be said now. And so, you know, the larger point is, and you make this too, the social media entities here want to do this. They don't feel like they're being coerced. They feel like this is an essential piece of cooperation that has to happen. The stopping of it is not in the interest of either party, right? The government, who wants to be able to warn that bad election information is being disseminated, and the platforms that want to warn their users.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not because the problem has gone away that this communication has ground to an almost halt. So every sort of threat assessment, intelligence assessment that has been publicly released since 2020 has indicated that the threat of attempted foreign interference in elections, including through sort of propaganda or disinformation or influence operations on social media platforms, is still there. And specific countries are often named in those federal intelligence assessments. And it makes sense, right? Because what we saw on January 6th, 2021, was really evidence, and the whole world saw it, that it's not that expensive to engage in an influence operation using various channels within the United States, including social media platforms, and actually cause major disruption. That was a huge disruption on January 6th, right? It was an attempted interference with the peaceful transfer of power. And I actually like to say that when Congress was under assault that day, they were actually serving in their function as election officials. They actually have a election official sort of function to receive all those electoral votes and count them up on that one day. So they were really being attacked because they were fulfilling that role of fairly counting all the votes and declaring the accurate winner and sort of fulfilling the will of the people. And so what, you know, I think that showed the whole world is that you don't need to hire a really sophisticated, you know, computer hacker to get into our voting machines. You can cause a lot of disruption through these influence operations. So by no means has that threat abated. If anything, there's all kinds of motivations for people to engage in that again. And unfortunately, as we also have seen in the wake of the 2020 election, there are a lot of elements within the United States, domestic elements, who are motivated to and have been engaging in the spread of false election information.
You mentioned the agencies that were swept into this case as, you know, under this theory of like deep state, you know, bad actors. But there's also been a whole bunch of lifelong misinformation researchers, people who this is their job in academic contexts. They've been swept in too, yeah?
Yeah. So even though those private entities, so researchers at universities like Stanford or the University of Washington, even though they were not named in this Missouri versus Murthy lawsuit as defendants, they have been sued in other lawsuits that really echo the same claims. So many of those researchers have been sued. there have also been congressional committee hearings that have really been part of this attack on really all the people that are trying to speak truth to these lies, really unearth the lies and debunk them with the correct and accurate information. It's a really multifaceted attack. Those people have been subpoenaed by these congressional committees, asked to, you know, release all kinds of records. And that's just obviously the kind of thing that would chill a lot of academics or civil society researchers who are really just trying to do their part along with the government and the social media companies to make sure that people have the correct information about the elections that they're participating in.
And now we're going to take a quick break to hear from some of our sponsors of this week's show. And now a message from our friends at refusefascism.org. Chances are the threat of fascism is weighing on you this year. But even when the F word is uttered, way too few of us are considering the full scope of the danger, let alone how to really stop it. The Refuse Fascism podcast, hosted by Sam Goldman, names it, dissects it, and connects in-depth analysis of what fascism is with the understanding and urgency we need to defeat it. And she is joined by great guests to discuss the threat of civil war, attacks on abortion rights and trans rights, Trump and the theocrats, Project 2025, efforts to erase history and critical thinking, and much more. Check out recent episodes featuring Jeff Charlotte, Sarah Posner, Waj Ali, our friend Mark Joseph Stern, yours truly, and many more. Subscribe to the Refuse Fascism podcast on your listening platform of choice, or go to refusefascism.org/podcast.
It's a new year, but it's the same old no law, just vibe Supreme Court. I'm Melissa Murray.
I'm Leah Littman.
I'm Kate Shaw. And we are the hosts of the Strict Scrutiny podcast on Crooked Media, who also happen to be constitutional law professors in our free time.
Join us each week as we unpack what's on the docket for the Supreme Court term and break down the latest headlines while still managing a laugh or two.
So whether you're a lawyer, a law student, or just trying to make sense of what these cases mean,
Strict Scrutiny has got you covered.
New episodes out every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for some bad decisions.
Let's return now to our conversation with Gauri Ramachandran on elections and free speech and disinformation and big tech. So you mentioned that there was a district court injunction that was very sweeping, and then the Fifth Circuit, in hearing this case on appeal, rolled back some of that injunction, but again, very vague, very sweeping, widespread uncertainty, as you noted above, about how this is to be implemented and what kind of communication between federal agencies and local election officials could continue. And then there's this test. The federal government seems to have been ordered not to have, quote, consistent and consequential communications with social media companies. I don't know what that means. Can you just talk a little bit about the utter confusion of the current state of play? And you noted that the injunction was lifted over the dissents of Justices Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch, but the court is hearing a case. In some sense, it almost doesn't matter because the confusion on the ground is already operative, right?
Yeah. So I am hopeful that after the court hears the case, they can lend some clarity to the situation. I don't think it will be possible for them to undo all of the damage that has been done and all of the chilling of both government agency and, as you mentioned, independent researchers' speech. It's really their speech that's being chilled. And I don't think the Supreme Court will be able to undo all of that damage, but I do hope they'll be able to lend some clarity. So, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns to this case, as you mentioned, and that's part of what I'm sure has created the confusion and the apprehension on the part of people who are trying to correct the record on elections. You know, initially there was this sweeping injunction. It even had an exception in it, actually, for communications related to foreign disinformation efforts. But if you think about it, if you're operating on the fly, it's hard to know when you see a post that says that a bunch of ballots are being thrown out in Maricopa County. It's hard to know where the person or the bot that is putting that online is located, right? And who are they answering to? Is that a foreign disinformation effort, or is that a local domestic disinformation effort, or just a voter who's really confused and saw something that they didn't understand? So in real time, when these things are happening and propagating around the internet, an order like that that says, don't worry, if it's foreign disinformation, you won't be violating a federal court order, is not very comforting, you know, particularly to a researcher who says, well, I can identify the disinformation, I can identify this pattern of behavior, but I don't, you know, have the resources and certainly not in a speedy way to figure out if this is a foreign disinformation effort or not. So we had this already when it started out, really difficult to apply district court order. Then the Fifth Circuit said, you know, some of the defendants that are subject to this really didn't engage in any coercion. So it doesn't make sense for them to be enjoined in this case. And actually, CISA was one of the defendants that initially the Fifth Circuit said, there's nothing they've done that's coercive. But then the Fifth Circuit in October essentially said, never mind, the CISA is subject to this order. And they said the reason was that CISA was essentially forwarding on reports from local and state election officials of problematic things they were seeing online about elections. And they said that in and of itself, despite the concession, essentially, that that's not coercive to tell people, I saw something false on your platform. Despite the fact that's not coercive, they held that that as a legal matter actually causes the social media platform's content moderation decisions to be state action. Then we have this Supreme Court stay that says none of that stuff is in effect anyway while we're waiting, we're getting the briefing and we're having the case being argued. And so you can understand why it's a really just confusing and chilling situation for people that just want to correct the record and really play their part in making sure that if people are going to go online looking for information about elections, they're most likely to see the right thing.
I'm hearing you say, and tell me if I'm reflecting back more than you're saying, that in a sense, this is scaling up just the general proposition that you don't need misinformation or disinformation. You just need these potent weapons of chilling speech and sowing confusion about who can be trusted, right? In other words, this just feels like the sort of classic Hannah Arendt, you know, it doesn't even matter if nobody trusts that election workers are being truthful and honest, if nobody trusts that the government warnings are truthful and honest, if we're in a moment where even though there's a stay, nobody feels comfortable doing their job to make sure that truthful speech prevails, then the aggregate effect is more confusion and mayhem and mistrust in the entire election apparatus.
You're right that, you know, if entities successfully engage in this sort of multifaceted attack on people who are trying to spread the truth, that it can have the same kind of effect as actually winning this sort of lawsuit would have, because the chilling effect can be so strong. I am hopeful that some of this damage can be reversed, though. One, because the Supreme Court may be able to bring some clarity to this case, some clarity to what are, you know, the guardrails around the government communicating with big tech. And then that's going to clearly provide some guidance to independent researchers and members of civil society as well. I'm also hopeful that, you know, as this issue is brought to light more, as folks like Senator Warner are bringing to light the fact that this communication has ground to a virtual halt, that Maybe some of the lawyers who tend to be a very cautious profession will see that there's downsides to being overly cautious, especially when your mission is to really, or part of your mission is to help the public and to do what is most beneficial for the safety, security, you know, of our free and fair elections. I hope that calling some attention to this chilling effect will motivate some of the attorneys who are probably giving some really cautious advice to their clients, you know, agencies in the federal government, motivate them to see the costs of being overly cautious and really help them highlight things like the exception in the district court order for communications about foreign disinformation, or for that matter, communications that are criminal, like criminal threats that are being made online. And also help them really take, you know, whatever guidance we get from the Supreme Court in this case and apply it in a pro-democracy manner.
I love the optimism, and I like that you're pointing us towards, you know, we all just need to be a little more courageous, particularly, you know, in terms of fighting for this and not sort of shrugging our shoulders and being, as my children say, confuzzled and paralyzed. We had a pretty harrowing discussion with Rick Hassin a few weeks ago, and then with Barb McQuaid last week about, you know, fake news and deep fakes and AIs and sort of the ways in which this really accelerating amount of interference with what is true and then uncertainty about what we're reading and consuming. And as I think you know, this year is this global experiment, right? We've got more voters than ever in history are going to head to the polls. 64 countries are having massively consequential elections. And there's so much opportunity to get in and screw it up. And I wonder if you think, just in the global context, we're ready, we know what we're preparing for. What are you kind of wanting our listeners to take away from this conversation in terms of there is a huge, huge tsunami headed toward us, and maybe they're not fully cognizant of the scope of it?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's hard for me to say whether the bigger danger is, you know, very convincing false information that people are going to get tricked by, you know, as they try to get informed and before they head to the polls across the globe, perhaps, you know, fueled by obviously much more sophisticated generative AI that's more freely available to the public. Or is the bigger danger that people are just going to be suspicious of everything they see and hear and read and, you know, just not be able to trust anyone, including, you know, folks that they should trust and that they should be getting their information from? So we will see how that plays out over the course of this year, as you said. But one thing I hope that listeners take home is that if you want to be a really informed voter, if you want to be an informed participant in democracy, it's your obligation to seek out accurate information. You know, if you're seeing a video of an election official talking about a problem at the polls, you could check, is that video actually hosted on the election official's website? Or are you just seeing this on Facebook and it's, you know, or on some other social media platform? You can check and see, are things actually hosted on official websites of people who have the authority to provide those facts? That's the kind of thing you can check for. You can demand of the, you know, news outlets that you go to that they are being proactive about making sure that what they're promoting to the public is accurate information. And you can support your local election officials and election workers for the heroic work that they're doing and show your appreciation for them in operating in this difficult environment.
Gauri Ramachandran serves as deputy director in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Her work focuses on election security, election administration, combating election disinformation. And her name is on one of the amicus briefs, the one filed by the Brennan Center in Murphy. Thank you so much for helping us find a way into thinking about this case that really kind of feels existential, and it feels like it's both sort of overlooked and underreported, but also kind of goes to the beating heart of these questions about the intersection of, you know, how we vote and how we find out how we vote and speech and government. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you covering this important case and this important topic.
And that's going to be a wrap for this episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening in. Thank you so much for your letters and your questions, and especially for your songs. You can always keep in touch at amicus@slate.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. Sarah Birmingham is Amicus's senior producer. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio at Slate. Susan Matthews is Slate's executive editor, and Ben Richmond is our senior director of operations. We'll be back with another episode of Amicus next week. Until then, hang on in there.